This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to Book Reviews. Each week, we read reviews from a variety of national book reviewers to help you find the best from the rest in new releases. Also included are popular audiobooks. So sit back and get ready to plan your next mental vacation with Book Reviews right here on your audio reading service.
Welcome. This is Book Reviews, and I'm your reader, John, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today I'll be reading from various resources for book reviews, and now I'll begin with the first one, which is from the Journal Gazette, copyright 2025, the Journal Gazette. This is from the Saturday, September 20th edition of the Journal Gazette. And the book is entitled Mailman, My Wild Ride Delivering the Mail in Appalachia and Finally Finding Home. This is written by Stephen Starling Grant, published by Simon & Schuster. This review was written by Todd C. Ream. It is headlined, Mail Bonding, White Collar Worker Turns Carrier Recounts Lessons We Can All Learn. While unfashionable to claim the United States Postal Service is underappreciated in terms of scale and precision of its operation, I must admit, I'm prone to complain when a parcel arrives a day later than I anticipated. I am also prone to complain when the price of the Forever stamp increases by a nickel. Of course, I am even more prone to complain about the local post office when I'm second in line. Am I prone to complain with such frequency in relationship to any other agency with which I so frequently interact? The honest answer is no. Such a realization leads to at least two other questions which I must contend. Why do I exercise such a sense of entitlement in relationship to the Postal Service? And am I merely exercising my constitutional right, albeit unwritten and thus limited in my interpretation, to be an ingrate? For me and any fellow ingrates, Stephen Starling Grant offers Mailman, My Wild Ride Delivering the Mail in Appalachia and Finally Finding Home. In candid, lucid, and even comical prose, Grant, who may himself be a recovering ingrate, offers a compelling first-person narrative of his tenure with the Postal Service, one that implicitly yet aptly diagnoses variant strands of postal entitlement. Wound into the diagnosis is also a balm for anyone left weary by the contentious age in which we live. Part of how Grant sets up the details he offers concerning his tenure is by examining the Postal Service's Herculean efforts. He notes that letter carriers are not simply letter carriers. They deliver everything ranging from unsolicited political pamphlets to beloved letters from one's mother. Federal Express and United Parcel Service only deliver packages. As a result, Grant contends, we carry everything for everybody with 99.993% accuracy. In fact, we carry many parcels for FedEx and UPS because they simply can't do it. They don't have our scale and reach. We do it all. If a 99.993% accuracy rate did not sling enough shame my way, the financial framework within which the Postal Service operates did. Contrary to my perceptions, Grant confirms at several points that the Postal Service does not receive public support. While committed to fulfilling a charge to serve the public dating all the way back to the first Postmaster General, Benjamin Franklin, the Postal Service's operations are funded by purchases of, for example, Forever stamps, whose price increase has only recently exceeded the rate of inflation. Part of the reason for those recent increases is that the Postal Service began replacing its fleet of 40-year-old Grumman long-life vehicles. In Grant's assessment, it is a crime that the country where engineers invented the airbag and modern collision avoidance systems, the country that put crumple zones and the shoulder seatbelt into mass adoption, continues to send hard-working people out on the road in these death traps. To send a response to my mother's beloved letters, I guess I can pay an extra nickel for a forever stamp. Mail carriers in Phoenix deserve air conditioning, and mail carriers in Minneapolis deserve heat. Far from simply being a shaming exercise for ingrates, the core of Grant's book is what one can learn from how his tenure with the Postal Service renewed his own sense of vocation. Grant, by training, is a consumer strategist, a vocational identity he details as another white-collar ghost with a job nobody understands. When COVID-19 struck, no one needed consumer strategists. Grant was not going to manipulate consumers into exercising retail therapy when they were worrying whether they could buy toilet paper. White-collar ghosts such as Grant found themselves among the first to lose their jobs. With a spouse and two daughters to support, Grant pursued service as a mail carrier, initially motivated by the need for health benefits. Grant believes working for something bigger than myself reconnected me with my family, with my town. In an age when encountering others as abstractions administered by social media and contractual obligations seems safe, Grant invites us to ride along as he delivers the mail in his LLV or when serving as a rural mail carrier just outside of Blacksburg, Virginia, his privately owned vehicle. Along the way, Grant's witty prose even offers readers successive invitations to laugh aloud as he, an abstraction no more, encounters all walks of life and even all walks of wildlife. While no laughing matter to mail carriers, Chapter 23, Under Color of Authority, includes Grant's most witty accounts. A popular cliche is that mail carriers and dogs are mortal enemies. Grant notes, he is a dog person, but also notes, I have never had a dog hate me the way I did when I was a mailman. Tragically, over 5,000 mail carriers are attacked by dogs every year, and the dogs always manage to kill a letter carrier every year or two. On a lighter side, Grant recounts the ways he sought to discern which weapon the law authorized him to unleash, a can of mace or a package scanner when repelling a mortal enemy. Fortunately for Grant, mere threats of force sufficed. In good conscience, he could contend no humans or canines were injured in the writing of this book. The sum of Grant's experiences accounts to an invitation extended to all his readers. As a mail carrier, Grant reveals, I wasn't just doing the job, but instead I was inhabiting something real, feeling what it was like to be there for the people. In the contentious age in which we live, Grant invitation compelled me to confront ways I succumb to live as an abstraction. Part of where change begins, of course, is by exercising the unfashionable but much-needed practice of saying thank you. This was a review of Mailman, my wild ride delivering the mail in Appalachia and finally finding home, written by Stephen Starling Grant, reviewed by Todd C. Ream. The following reviews are found in Publishers Weekly, copyright 2025, PWXYZ LLC is the copyright. This is reading from the July 14th issue of Publishers Weekly, and the first review is of a book titled Little Movements, written by Laura Morrow, published by Random House. Little Movements. Morrow's tender debut traces a black woman's rocky path to becoming an artist. Narrator Lila Smart was raised by a mother who didn't encourage her dreams. Now, 33, Layla takes a leap of faith shortly after a miscarriage puts a strain on her marriage to Eli, an aspiring filmmaker who has become complacent as an IT specialist. She leaves Brooklyn and her publicity job for a 9-month residency at Briar House, a Vermont dance studio, where she'll choreograph a performance. The mostly white town is awash in Black Lives Matter sign, and she's aware that the studio is attempting to improve its poor record on diversity. Though she's uncomfortable with being tokenized, she devotes herself to the piece, hoping to honor the accomplished group of dancers, all of whom are black. Her distance from Eli puts a further strain on their marriage, especially after she calls him to announce she's unexpectedly pregnant with their child. More complications ensue after troubling revelations about Briar House's history and its reason for suddenly becoming inclusive. Morrow leavens the heavy theme of grief, insecurity, and racism with Layla's sharp, self-deprecating humor. What if they meant to invite Lila Smart or something, she asks Eli, not believing Briar House meant to accept her. What begins as a tale of self-fulfillment blossoms into a memorable meditation on power in the culture industry. Our next review is of a book called Playing Wolf. This was written by Zuzana Rehova. It was translated from the Czech by Alex Zucker. It's published by Catapult Books. Rehova makes her English language debut with a devilishly creepy work of folk horror set in rural Chechia, Bohuma and Bohumlia. Move with present-day Prague to Podlisi with their developmentally disabled 12-year-old son, expecting a charming retreat and a chance to start fresh. Instead, they find themselves in a cold, dark home surrounded by shifty neighbors. For years, they have grappled with their son's undiagnosed condition, which has driven a wedge between them. When they arrive in Podlisia, Bohumlia is bandaged and stitched, and she scratches at her unspecified wounds incessantly. Meanwhile, Bohumil drinks heavily to cope with insomnia. Alone one night in a pub, Bohumila imagines the local hunters and farmers are viewing her as prey, fueling the fear she shares with her husband that the town folks are out to get them. One morning, soon after, the point of view switches to that of Slava, the game warden, who takes the couple's boy on a fox hunt and reimagines Little Red Riding Hood with Bohumila as the girl and himself as the wolf. The author effectively builds tensions from the couple's fears, which are heightened by physical threats, as when Bohumil finds a large paw print outside their home, as well as their failure to find comfort in each other. It's hair-raising. Our next review from the Publishers Weekly is entitled Good and Evil. This is written by Samantha Swablin. It's translated from the Spanish by Megan McDowell. This is published by Knopf. Argentine writer Swablin mimes readers' deepest fears in her striking third story collection, After Seven Empty Houses. It opens with Welcome to the Club, about a wife and mother's aborted suicide attempt and subsequent chastising by her neighbor, a reclusive hunter, who gives her a knife to butcher her daughter's pet rabbit. You have to pay the price, he tells her. In An Eye in Throat, a man looks back on the traumatic episode from his childhood that left him mute. Memories of long-ago calamities also fuel a fabulous animal in which the narrator gets a call from her old friend, Layla, who wants to talk about the narrator's role in the accident that killed Layla's 7-year-old son many years earlier. The woman from Atlantida, in which a woman remembers the summer night she and her older sister snuck out of their house as children to swim in the ocean, and her sister drowned. In the spectacular and disturbing Closer, a visit from the chief, a woman visiting her mother in a nursing home, brings an escape patient to her apartment only to have the woman's son show up to rob and brutalize her. Each entry is more luminous and shocking than the last. This establishes Swablin as a master storyteller. Our next review is of a book entitled Ripeness, written by Sarah Moss, published by Farr, Strauss, and Gros. In Moss's layered and poignant latest, after the memoir My Good Bright Wolf, an aging divorced English woman reflects on the nature of home and family while living in Ireland. Edith enjoys a casual relationship with a German potter and a fulfilling friendship with long-married local woman Mabe in County Clare. Edith's story is informed by alternating flashbacks to the mid-1960s, when she comes of age in northern England and is dispatched by her mother, a World War II refugee from France, to assist her older sister Lydia, a professional ballerina, who is about to give birth in rural Italy. With the paternal details of Lydia's pregnancy shrouded in secrecy, Edith busies herself with Lydia's physical and emotional care as she vows to give the baby up for adoption. In the present day, Meeb receives a letter from an American man claiming to be her half-brother, but is ambivalent about inviting him to visit. Meanwhile, Edith rues the man's claim on a land to which he's never been, while she eternally feels like a stranger, especially given the rising anti-refugee sentiment. Moss's characters are delightfully complex, giving shape to a narrative meditation on belonging. This leaves readers with much to chew on. This is a review of Ripeness by Sarah Moss. Our next review, also found in Publishers Weekly, is entitled Mit Out Sound. This book was written by Rick Lenz and published by Chromadroid. Former actor Lenz, hello rest of my life, delves into Hollywood film lore with his immersive latest about a personal assistant Chaotic's 1970s quest to complete an obscure, unfinished film rumored to have co-starred John Wayne and James Dean. Emily Bennett's first hears about Showdown's 1955 production from a fellow extra on a 1973 TV shoot. A few years later, while working on an foreign actor on the set of The Shootist, Wayne's final film, she works up the courage to ask the taciturn star about Showdown, but fails to convince him to finish it. "I'm too old to play myself," Wayne says. After Wayne dies in 1979, she recruits Wayne impersonator Tom Manfredo and Dean impersonator Jimmy Riley to act in the film, and a love triangle develops as she falls for Tom while Jimmy nurses his feelings for her. Things get a bit unwieldy in the melodramatic third act, with a pair of shoehorned and occasionally confusing Oedipal motifs. One character has killed his father, and another may have had sex with his mother. But for the most part, Lenz, who also appeared in The Shootist, offers a fascinating perspective on Hollywood's golden age and its pull on his cast. This is worth a look. This was a self-published book written by Rick Lenz. And our final review for today is The Girl with Ice in Her Veins, a Lisbeth Salander novel. This is written by Kieran Smirnoff, translated from the Swedish by Sarah Death. This was published by Knopf. Smirnoff's second millennium novel, after The Girl in the Eagle's Talons, is a treat for long-time series fans. Several months after the events of the previous book, Lisbeth Salander's 13-year-old niece, Zayla Herrick, is interning at a newspaper, Gaskasken. She also is part of an environmental activist group whose newest member, Simon Frisk, is an advocate for extreme, sometimes violent, protest. When Simon sexually assaults Salva and one of the teenage reporter's friends turns up murdered, she links up with a dangerous ally to take revenge. Meanwhile, Mikael Blomkvist is hired to helm Gaskins, fresh off of his cancer diagnosis, while Elizabeth searches for her hacker friend Plog, who has been kidnapped by Marcus Branco, the sadistic crime lord who killed Salva's mother, and seeks a hard drive containing $400 million in Bitcoin that only Salva can unlock. It's a lot of plot, and Smirnoff makes no room for newcomers to the series, assuming that readers have near photographic memory of details from the previous novels. Those who have been following along closely, however, will be rewarded with forceful prose, clever twists, and poignant developments in the relationships among the core cast. This continues Smirnoff's hot streak. This is a review of The Girl with Ice in Her Veins, a Lisbeth Salander novel by Kieran Smirnoff. Well, that's all the time we have for today. And this has been John with Book Reviews. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library.